Welcome to Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. It's like coffee with an analyst, but there's no actual coffee. Each episode, we interviewed an expert in the field of law enforcement analysis to share their career-defining stories and to get their insights on the world. Please join us on recognizing and learning from these brilliant minds as we define the law enforcement analysis profession one episode at a time.
Thank you for joining me. I hope many aspects of your life are progressing. My name is Jason Alder, and today our guest has over 24 years of law enforcement analysis experience, all of which with Calgary Police Service, focusing on gangs, organized crime, homicide, and now human trafficking. She has over 20 years experience teaching and is currently the instructor for Mount Royal University in Calgary, Alberta. She's also an instructor for both IALEA and IACA. So yes, we have our first Canadian on our show, eh? Please welcome Tracy Lowy. Tracy, how are we doing?
It's great to be here, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's good to catch up with you. We met in the Fiat training years ago. And so it is great to talk to you. My first question seems always the same these days. How did you discover the law enforcement analysis profession?
Well, it started actually when I was in high school. It was every time I was asked to write a paper, it would be on criminal behavior. So I'd research it, and I was just really interested in that type of personality and how they became who they were, right? And then I watched Silence of the Lambs, to tell you the truth. I saw that when it came out, and all I ever wanted to be was a profiler. So from there on, I chose my career based on criminal justice, psychology, and then I did a master's degree in criminal justice so I could teach, because I knew that I always wanted to teach as well. So how it started with the Calgary Police Service is that I volunteered in the stolen property unit for about a year, and then there was a crime analysis position that came available in one of the districts. So I interviewed for that, and I got it. And I remember sitting in my car once they did my fingerprinting and giving me my ID card and everything. And I have never been that excited in my life that I finally worked for the Calgary Police Service. So yeah, I started there. And then as soon as I started, it was just, it's been a progression. I've been so fortunate to be in so many different units. And so it was just one of those things that I knew where I wanted to work, but there were no crime analyst positions at the time. So I was just lucky going through university and all of that. When I got out, there were some positions. So it's been an amazing career.
So you start out in the gang unit, and throughout this interview, what I want to do is talk about the differences that you've witnessed in Canada versus what you've seen in the U.S., because I know you've done a lot of teaching in the U.S. So you start out in the gang unit. What type of activities are you doing when you first start working for Calgary?
Well, actually, I started out in the district. So it was called District 3 is where I started. And when you're first a new analyst in the district, you're just learning everything, right? So you're going to the parades with the officers. You're mapping for them. You're getting to know all the suspects in your area. Because District 3 consisted of, like, I don't know how many communities back then, but I was getting to know all the bad guys, the victims, the people who lived in the area, what type of crimes were going on in the area, and doing a lot of pattern analysis. So when we'd have stolen vehicles, we'd have break and enters. So that's the kind of work that I was doing in the district. From the district, I moved to SHOP, which is our Serious Habitual Offender Program, and I really got involved with youth and young offenders, because this was our unit where we were involved with the families, with the youth, and trying to help them exit out of any kind of gang life or any serious criminal behavior that they were getting into when they were kids. And then we moved on to that. And then I moved from there. I went to organized crime. It was target enforcement unit and drugs. Target enforcement is just another name for gangs. So I was doing that for about 10 years. What we saw in there is we had a rivalry between two Asian-based gangs here in Calgary, the FOBs and the FKs. And I literally worked them for 20 years because it was back and forth, shootings, homicides, assaults, you name it, they were doing everything. So I was involved in mostly Asian-based crime for about 20 years. And then I moved to homicide and I took on the role as an analyst there. And we were very much involved in all different types of homicides, right? But still, there was a gang component of it. So it was really good that I could bring my gang experience into homicide. And after homicide, I went back to gang for 3 years. And then recently, I've just gone to human trafficking. And it's been excellent because it's a whole new learning curve for me. And I'm learning something new. And it's been fascinating so far.
With organized crime and the two gangs that you mentioned there, what are their particular characteristics? What's their activity or vices that they're fighting over? What's the history there?
Well, the history with the two of the FOB and the FKs, it was drug dealing. It started years ago and it was their parents that were doing it. And then they all met in high school and then they divided into these two different gangs. And it was their parents dealing drugs. Then they took it over, all of that. And then all the shootings started happening. They'd be in the bar together. They'd see each other in the rival gangs. And that's what they were basing everything on. Yeah, it was drugs.
In terms of your role as the analyst, I mean, what type of task are you doing to support the gang unit?
Oh, a lot of cell phone analysis, a lot of tracker analysis, TDR, which is transmission data recorder, so your phones, all those types of analysis where you're building a story for them from their cell phone or from the vehicle that we have a tracker on, and you're doing the analysis, but you're coming back to the investigator saying, here's a good starting point tomorrow. These are who they hang out with all the time. He's on the phone with this person every night and every morning. Things like that to move the investigation forward.
As you're learning all this about these gangs, what are some either lessons learned or some issues that you're trying to work around as an analyst and trying to solve?
I guess some of the things are is the way that we collect data. I know in human trafficking right now, we don't have enough drop-down menus in our MRS to capture the data for human trafficking. So our members will show up at a scene of a homicide, you know, aggravated assault, robbery, or whatever, and there'll be witnesses that are girls that look like they could possibly be in human trafficking, but there's no subcategory for them to say that when they're putting the report in, possibly related to human trafficking. So we're having trouble getting information on this because we could go back as a human trafficking unit and talk to them. And so we're really working on that now. And Calgary Police Service is getting way better at identifying sex trafficking and putting info posts, which are reports, in the system so we can have that information. But that's the one thing that I find is frustrating for us, is trying to get the data collected so we can actually do analysis on it.
You said MRS? What is that?
No, it's RMS. It's our, it's our system. Okay. Yeah, okay. Sorry.
No, it's okay. I thought maybe in Canada there was, based on how you referenced it, I thought, well, that sounds like RMS, but she said MRS. So I thought maybe it's a little different up north. So,
well, it's because the university I teach at is MRU. So I probably just thought when I was saying that, it is RMS.
No worries. So let's get into human trafficking then, because as you mentioned, it's fairly new to you. It's what you're currently doing. This is a topic that we have not covered on the show. So let's start from the beginning, start fresh in terms of, let's develop a general definition of human trafficking, and then let's go into all the different parts from there.
So we have a definition here in Canada. It refers to the recruitment, transportation, harboring, or exercising control, direction, or influence over the movements of a person in order to exploit that person. And typically this is through sexual exploitation or forced labor. What it really does fall under is the control of somebody. There will be no consent. They'll be subject to violence. They'll take their passport, no money, and no support. So they can't have support from their families or from even friends because they are kept very close in close, tight quarters with these pimps.
That's gets tough then to differentiate between, okay, you're here working for me as a prostitute versus now I am forcing you to do something. So what are some indicators there that help law enforcement make that transition from prostitution to now sex trafficking?
Mostly, and we're finding this with the girls that are here from Quebec, is that the girls are lured with them under visions of grandeur. Like they think that they're going to have nice cars, a really nice house, nice clothes, get their nails done, their hair done, all of that. And they're being manipulated. The interesting part is the script is always the same from the pips. It's very much a script that they do. And then all of a sudden it shifts and it will be emotional abuse, physical abuse, control. They call it psychological warfare because these women actually believe that this is their boyfriend. They do. And when you ask them, they believe this. And so then they realize that the pimps will move them across the country. So they'll have no support system, no ID. They might have a drug addiction. They can't leave the house to make friends. And they will turn to, you work for me. I'm not your boyfriend. You work for me. So they're terrified. And a lot of them don't speak the language, right? They don't speak English. So this is a big challenge. And the interesting part too, is that a pimp here can make $15,000 a week with a girl who cooperates. So they really need them to cooperate. This was in a podcast I watched too. They were saying that drugs they can sell once, a girl they can sell numerous times. So that's why it's so lucrative for the pimp. The catch is they have to have the cooperation of the girl or this doesn't work. So that's what happens. There's control. They may even brand them. They might not, they don't let them leave the house unless the pimp or a driver is with them. They don't have any support. They're terrified. And then they'll move from province to province to province. So they might not even know what city they're in. So these girls are absolutely terrified and they're not allowed. They're not allowed out of the house. So they can't ask for help or they can't find some friends that might help them.
Okay. So that seems to me a big difference then. Because if they're in prostitution, they're most likely, or I would envision that they're out on the corner trying to get Johns and trying to have that relationship with clients versus this sex trafficking where they are on lockdown and they're only brought out, I would imagine, in certain situations at certain times in certain locations. And that's the big difference.
Well, it is too. Yeah, they are. They're only allowed out, you know, with their pimp. And plus, now a lot of our prostitution is not on the street corner anymore. It's on the internet. They make everything is done through the internet. So our integrated child exploitation unit is just overrun with cases because there's so much sexual exploitation on the internet now because they can plan everything. And websites like Leo's List and Spotlight, where they advertise there and they can do it all through the internet. And then they just meet the person. So there's not a lot of, there's still some on the street corners, but not like it used to be.
Okay. So it's like Uber,
yeah,
right? Yes, you, instead of flagging down a taxi on the street, we're using the phones to call up a cab. And so now same thing with the prostitution.
Exactly. Yep. It is.
One thing I'm having trouble with is understanding why go through sex trafficking if you can do prostitution.
What usually happens is they start in prostitution, then they're trafficked. Is what happens unless they're being brought over from a different country and they're under the idea that they're going to be a babysitter. They're going to be working in a massage parlor, a nail salon, something like that. They're coming consensually at that time because they think they're going to be working and making money. But what happens is when they get over here, they're pushed right into sex trafficking.
Okay. You mentioned that there's a need for cooperation. And it makes me think that are these, when it comes to sex traffickers, are the sexual acts more deviant? Or I guess why is the cooperation aspect needed?
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's more deviant, but there's definitely more control, right? Like these pimps need these girls to cooperate or they don't make any money, right? So it's violence, it's control. It's they take everything away from them, like their passport, money, support, friends, family. So they need them to participate in this or there is no income for the pimps.
Well, do you think there's more money to be made in sex trafficking as opposed to prostitution?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They'll have many girls working for them and it's billions of dollars a year.
In terms of Calgary, then what are you seeing that's maybe unique to Calgary in terms of sex trafficking and human trafficking?
So what we find is that, you know, we talked about sex trafficking workers is still being legal in Canada, but we also have, there's the Mann Act, it's called from 1910 in the United States, where you can't transport a sex worker across state lines. Well, for us, you can. They can transfer them across Canada. There's no law saying they can't. So that's different. And we have what are strictly Asian micro brothels. And the women that are in these brothels know what's going on. There's profit sharing. There's no strict physical or emotional control over them. They can come and go when they want. So that's very different than what we're seeing with the girls that are lured from Quebec. That's very different. They're brothels. They're all over the city, but they're paid and they can come and go as they want. These girls from Quebec, they can't. They are totally controlled by their pimps.
So why do you have one scenario in Calgary and the other one in Quebec?
I think what it is a lot of the pimps are moving their girls to Calgary because we don't have the manpower. In Quebec, they have 86 investigators in their human trafficking unit, and we only have six. We just don't have the manpower. We're going to try to get more, but we just don't have the manpower right now.
So then from the angle as an analyst, what are you working on and how are you trying to help this scenario?
So what I do is I spend a lot of time on Leo's List and Spotlight, going through the Crime Stoppers tips that we receive or any intelligence that we've received, and trying to match tattoos, trying to see if these girls are on there. And are some of them, can you tell they're crying out for help? Or what is it? Or take their phone numbers and see if I can relate it back to a pimp. And that's the kind of work we're doing now, is going through the websites. And then, of course, with the investigators that I work with, they have a lot of experience in this. So we are working files right now on our micro brothels. We are just taking a file down that we had with Quebec. And another one, a friend of mine, he just took one down that he did literally off the side of his desk because it was in his community. So those are the things we're working towards now. We're also getting the investigators and the street patrol to understand what human trafficking is so they can identify it and then send the information to us so we have something to work on. And then we have an analyst in the CIU, and she's working up from the intelligence side of human trafficking and labor trafficking. And then we share information back and forth on some of the names she comes across. Are we looking at them? And then we'll work them up. So it's working out really well.
So in terms of the general information that you give the street officer, if these folks are in lockdown, maybe in buildings or housing, then how are officers even coming into contact with
it will women? Be a lot of the times it's at an accident when the girls are in the car, things like that. You can see them not talking. They don't speak English. They're quiet. Or some of these are at brothels, right? And we'll do a bust and get them there. That kind of information. But you're right, we don't get into the houses like until we do a takedown, till we make the arrests, right? But if the girls are at a shooting, at a homicide, at a robbery, something like that, that's when the investigators can talk to them. And they can see there's something going on here. I want to talk to this victim. And they might not talk, but if they put it in their report, then the human trafficking unit can go and talk to them and see if they're okay. Or do they need help to get out of this lifestyle?
If there is a language barrier, then that would mean that you're going to need more bilingual officers. Is that correct? You talked about only having six on this, but then you have to have, of the six, you're going to have bilingual officers in order to communicate with these folks.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've got a new officer coming to us, an investigator, and he speaks French. So that's going to help us a lot, right? And we have other people, agencies, of course, are involved with us too, like Reset Calgary and different agencies that are willing to help the girls in their programming. They have bilingual that can help us as well.
A lot of these women speak French?
Yeah, from Quebec, they speak French. Yeah.
Okay.
And then in the Asian brothels, of course, they'll speak their language, native language, right?
There's a sex trafficking piece, which we've touched on a little bit, but then there's also the forced labor piece as well. Does that have different characteristics?
Yeah, a lot of the times the women or girls will believe they're coming over to be a babysitter, to work in a salon, to do nails, things like that. They truly believe that's what they're coming to. And then when they get here, their pimps will take their passports, bring them to a house. And then all of a sudden there's this debt. It will be, you owe us for the flight that we paid for. You owe us for the fake ID. All of this. So there's this accrued debt immediately. Then they have them working in strip clubs, bars, brothels, all of that. They'll have them working in all of those different types, and they have to pay back this debt. And these girls are kept, you know, with these pimps 24/7. They're picked up, dropped off. They're fed very little. Like, it's just, there's a whole different world of this when it's labor trafficking that turns into it, because a lot of times they believe they're coming over to be a babysitter and that kind of job, and it turns into sex trafficking. And a lot of the work we have done, it says most often it does, from labor trafficking into sex trafficking.
Now, do you ever find that these women eventually pay off their debt and are freed?
No, they would rarely would they be able to get to the, because they'll just keep adding to it, right? They just will come up with something else that they have to pay for, or they'll have done something wrong and they'll charge them, you know, another $5,000, that kind of stuff. So they'll never be out of debt for them. And unless the girls decide to leave. And that's very dangerous because if they find them, they could kill them. But if they don't, if they get away, that has happened.
Well, do you have a particular case that you'd like to go over? And
there is one. Yes, it's a human trafficking one. It wasn't my case, but a good friend of mine, he worked it and he did extremely well to get the charges that he did get. What it was is he was focusing on the neighborhood. The neighbors and him noticed it in the neighborhood. So he did all his own surveillance, everything, because of course he didn't have a team. And it was fantastic. He realized the difference with these pimps too, was that they were trying to befriend the families and befriend the kids and try to not stick out in the community, right? Trying to meet it. But the neighbors knew. They just felt something was wrong. There was a lot of Quebec plates, all this stuff that was adding up. So it didn't make sense to them. So they worked it and they did get charges out of it. And it was incredible the work that went into it. And this is where he saw that there was specific scripts that were these primps were using with these girls, and why they called it psychological warfare, because they're absolutely controlled by these pimps when they spoke with the girls. Just absolutely controlled. They had been moved here. They hadn't been out of the house. They couldn't make any friends. They didn't have any support outside of it. It was a file that was just, I think it's going to be precedent setting for what we're doing now. I think that's what we're going to see, because I think a lot of the investigators also, like the officers on the street, are going to be able to look for this and watch for it more.
What were some things that the officer had to prove? What was a key bit of evidence in the case?
Well, I think what it was is that they had to get witnesses, right? Mm-hmm. They had to actually get witnesses to come to court and say this was happening. And he was able to do that and get the girls to come forward and actually testify. Right. And not be so terrified that they go back, or they just are so scared that, you know, the family members are going to be killed. They're going to be killed. All the threats from the pimps keep them on board. And that's what's happening. And that's why it's a really precedent setting case, because they're seeing what can actually really happen. You know, when you get witnesses to come forward, you can shut these pimps down. Right. And you take one pimp off the street, that could be 100 girls, right, that aren't being sex trafficked. Right? And they just use the example, like you can sell cocaine once or a girl 10 times. Well, you take a pimp off the street, that can save hundreds of girls, right? Depends how lucrative it is for them.
So what happens to these women? They've testified, they're out of the pimp's hands, so to speak. What happens next to them?
Well, it depends, right? They might go into witness protection, or we've got many programs in here, and one of them is called Reset Calgary. And it's a program that the women, if they just get out, can come to initially for 6 weeks. And then there's a year-long program to help them decide what they want to do with their life and give them options and training and counseling and help them see where they want to go so they can have the life that they want instead of being caught up in this sex trade world and feeling like they have to go back to the sex trade world. So we have that program, but it just depends, because we've had very few go through court, right? So it depends if they might have to go to witness protection.
Are you aware, is there any upcoming law changes or anything maybe on the higher level in which to help identify and help with this trafficking situation?
There was one a couple of years ago, and yes, it is helping. It is very much what we're focused on right now. Human trafficking, sex trafficking is very much kind of what we're talking about in the media, at work. They created a new unit, all that. So yes, I believe that new laws will come into play in the next few years to help us. It's just so prevalent now, because for so many years, we always kept saying, well, that's not happening in Calgary. That only happens in China, in Thailand. We thought like that, and it's not true. It's happening right here.
You're in this field long enough, there will be that attitude towards everything, right? Yeah. I remember even growing up as a kid, the neighborhood that I grew up in, we don't have drugs here. We don't have a drug problem here. And then, you know, when I was a young adult coming up in Baltimore, you know, there was a lot of communities that would say, oh, we don't have gangs here. That's not something that happens here. You know, we don't have organized crime here. And it's interesting that that's the attitude of the folks until, yes, you do have it. And it's usually pretty prevalent by the time the community realizes it.
Well, it is. And the other thing too, is when I teach my class at the university, it's not a topic people want to talk about. Like, mm-hmm. It's not easy to start talking about sex trafficking and the manipulation and how the girls are so emotionally and physically abused. They don't, like even my students who love to learn about all of this, when we were talking about sex and human trafficking, it was disturbing to some of them. They were like, I can't believe this, but they want to learn about it, but they're just so shocked that it's happening here.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to get into your analyst badge stories, and I want to talk about you as an instructor and talk a little bit about IALEA and IACA.
Sure. That sounds great.
You're listening to Analyst Talk with Jason Elder. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Nadia Tuominen, and I just wanted to say, get off your cell phone. How are you going to be perceptive and observational if everything you perceive and observe is on a tiny rectangular screen? Not okay. Get off your cell phone.
Hi, this is Mary Berticelli. Would you like to solve a cold case? If your answer is yes, then enter a cold case from your agency into VICAP, the FBI's Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. Thanks.
Hi, this is Steve French, and I have a little phrase for you to remember. A phrase that stuck with me throughout my time as an analyst is a quote from Sherlock Holmes. When you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Welcome back, Tracy. What I want to get into now is your analyst badge story. And for those that may be new to the show, the analyst badge story is the case or project that is the career-defining moment for the analyst. You can have more than one. And in this case, you do have more than one. You have an homicide case that you're going to talk about, and then you're going to talk about the students that you teach. But for now, let's start with the homicide case. How did you get started on that case, and where did it go?
Well, I was very fortunate. I was in the homicide unit, and we had had a series of homicides in 2016, and they decided to create a task force. So myself and 14 other members were assigned to this team, and it was Asian-based organized crime. And because I had worked it for so long, we knew the players really well. We also had the MO of all the homicides. We had a lot of great evidence leading us towards conviction. So the part for me that was really fantastic was that I was able to learn how to do all the analysis of trackers, cell phones, Cellbrite data. We dumped cell towers, and all of this was relatively new to me. I've been in homicide for a couple of years, but to be able to put them all together and see the value that it really adds to the investigation. And when you testify in court, how the judge really does take a look at your data, and they value the phone data a lot, because they'll be saying whatever the bad guy or the accused has said, we can prove it right or wrong in the cell phones, right? And so it's very much a tool that is really valuable. So I was just grateful to be a part of that team, because for 3 years we had our own surveillance. We were just able to do so much. And then being able to testify is also something as an analyst that I think is really beneficial to your career. It really shows you how your work is important, and it gives you a different perspective, because there's a lot of work that goes into it, but boy, is it ever rewarding when you get the conviction.
And what year was this?
2016.
And then how many homicides were there?
There were 6.
All at once?
No.
And then, so was this getting back to rival gangs fighting, or
it was.
Is this something that there? Okay.
Yeah, it was FOB-FK again.
Okay. With the 6 homicides, were they all basically done the same way in terms of the homicide?
Absolutely. Yes, they were. That was the best part about it. We had one MO going through it. So that's how we knew they were all linked.
What was that MO?
I can't really talk about the MO yet, but it was one that was so consistent that we knew right away. That's how we got the task force. We knew that we had to follow through with this, because we knew on the last one that it was definitely the same MO as we've had all along.
So then, as you're getting your feet wet in a lot of different analysis tools, you've mentioned with the telephone. So
yep.
I guess, what was some lessons learned, or what was some advice that you have for people that may not have gotten into a case such as that, where they're doing a lot of telephone tolls, but what's your advice for the newbies out there?
I think the first thing that I really would like to say is that add meaning to your analysis, like providing insight how you came up with the suspect, or how you connected them to the trend, the MO, anything like that. Provide an explanation, because you're adding meaning and you're telling the story so the investigators will understand it. And also always be looking for the pattern. There's a pattern in everything. Phone data, whether it's a fender that the beanies are being over the like a period of 6 months or whatever. It's the same person all the time. You know it. Explain that story out, like, and tell them why. And especially provide meaning when you are creating a map, an I2 chart, like an association chart or a timeline. Make sure it tells a story so they can follow it and it's adding to the investigation. Because if you just give them your cell phone analysis with your methodology and nothing that's explaining it, it's not really helpful. The other thing is you always want to make sure that your analysis is relevant and actionable. If it's dated and they can't action on it, it's not really helpful to the investigators, right? So think of the bigger picture. Okay, so if found this one person and he's got a specific MO and then you found his vehicle and then he's stealing vehicles, think of the bigger picture. You might want to contact stolen auto, you know, all these kind of things, because there will be a bigger picture. And then critical thinking is the best thing that you can have and use as an analyst. Just always be curious. Just be curious about, no, that doesn't make sense to me. And trust your intuition, because you're right. If it doesn't make sense to you, it's not going to make sense to the investigators. And then the last thing is always make recommendations. When you're if you're doing phone analysis, a profile of a target, the most important part of the profile isn't all the checks that you did. It's the summary at the top where you have explained who this person is. You've brought it all together. All the checks, everything. This person is a drug dealer. They've been seen at homicide scenes. Their parents are drug dealers. You know, everything that they have, that you have on them, summarize them for the investigator, because that's what they're going to need. They don't have time to go through every one of your checks that you've done in the profile to pull it all together. That's our job. We need to pull it all together for them.
You put on your Fiat instructor hat there.
Yes, I did.
Actionable. That was straight out of the...
Yeah, don't we know it?
So then it seems to me what you're talking about in terms of, you know, you have your product, whether it's a map, link chart, association chart, but then there's either the written communication, the report that goes along with that product, mm-hmm. or there's the oral presentation
right.
that goes along with that. Right. So both of those. So it's not just a standalone map or chart, that there has to be something. The chart's not going to tell the entire story.
That's exactly it. And you can have, like, we have the maps for sure for court. We have the profiles for court. We have our, you know, IT charts, everything for court. But for the investigators right at the beginning, when you give it to them, they need something to know what the story is about this, right? And then same within court. When you're going in, see if it's a jury trial or a judge, they'll be looking at your map. You need to be able to explain it down to a detail level that they really understand what you're saying.
During this investigation, how were you treated in terms of the other members of the task force, right? Because you're new.
Oh, it was outstanding. Like I was one of the team members. I knew a lot of these homicide investigators because we kind of grew up in the police service together. Mm-hmm. So I knew a lot of them and the respect was absolutely there. Okay, and great. So they valued my opinion, they valued my work, and they didn't have to question my data analysis. And that was what was really nice about being on a team like that.
So then what kinds of things, and if you can't talk particulars, that's fine, I understand. But when you testified then, what particular things were you testifying over?
I've only ever testified on cell phone analysis. Okay. So it's, yeah, my analysis of the phones and the maps that I created from the cell phones.
Again, is there lessons learned or advice that you have for someone that's never testified, but, you know, is about to?
Yes. Make sure, like, I pretty well knew every time I've testified, I knew the data as well as I knew for my master's thesis. That's how well you should know it, because there are going to be questions being thrown at you. You're nervous, right? Because it's nerve-wracking every time, you are nervous, but just really know your data and be able to explain it in a way that you are speaking to every level, like every level that could possibly be in the courtroom, because they've got to understand it at the common sense level. Like, okay, if his phone was here and he's pinging off this cell tower and the homicide is right there, you've got to be able to explain that, right? You can't just show it. You got to say, okay, this is where he lives. This is where his phone is pinging. And this is where the homicide scene was. And you have the exact times of everything, right? So you just explain that. But you got to be concise for one thing, and also make sure you really know your data.
When you testified, did it seem like the judge, prosecutor, the defense, even maybe the jury, did they seem like this was common practice and that they'd understood the lingo? And this is something that's kind of more in tune with what we expect in the courtroom now.
Right. Sometimes. So <Okay. laughs> sometimes when I testified, it was really straightforward and easy. They understood it. And then other times, the judges even said after, you know, like, well, I wasn't quite sure about this, you know, and we thought, well, why didn't you ask? You know, but the thing is, the defense is looking for any mistake you've made. That's what they're doing. They're looking for any mistake. So make sure there's no mistakes in your data and be able to answer, because the Crown is fine. But when the defense gets a hold of you and they're asking you questions, they are looking for any mistake and they're looking to trip you up on anything you'd say. So you need to be confident in your analysis and just really know. And the good part is the Crown gives you the list of questions that they're going to ask you, but you don't get that from the defense. So you have no idea what the defense is going to ask you.
Did you say Crown?
Yeah. Our Crown prosecutor. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I figured that one out too, but I thought I wanted to make sure that's what you said. Well, let's talk a little bit about you as an instructor. And another part of your badge story, as mentioned, is just your experience sharing your knowledge with the students. When you were talking from the very beginning, it seemed like right away that you had this desire to teach, and which I find fascinating. So let's get into that a little bit and talk about your experience as a teacher.
Yeah, I really did. When I was in undergrad, I did a psych undergrad and I thought it was great. And I thought, no, I need to do a master's so I can actually teach. Because at the time at Mount Royal University, you didn't need a PhD. You needed a master's. So I did that so I could teach. And then I started there and it's been fantastic. I've been able to teach like 10 different classes there over the years. And then in 2012, I wrote a crime and intelligence analysis course and I teach it every fall there now. So every year I get to go in and work with the students and share what I've learned. And there's always so many new things that I'm bringing to the class, like what we learned for cell phone analysis or how we made predictive analysis even better, how it went automated, right? Like things like that, like programs like GeoTime. Once we got GeoTime, how it made our cell phone analysis so much better and so much easier. But I get to share that with them. And I think the best part is how many want to be analysts since they've taken not just my course, but heard about becoming an analyst. Like every year that I teach it, so many of them are asking, okay, where can I volunteer? How do I get on as an analyst? What can I do to make my resume stand out? So it's just such a reward for me to see how many are interested in our field and that they really want to follow in our footsteps.
Does the university have a internship program or how is that usually set up for the students?
They don't here in Canada. No, I've tried and it's just not going to work with our union, but they do have internships for the students so they can get different kinds of experience. They can volunteer with the police service. We just don't have a volunteer with analysts.
Oh, well, that's interesting. What do they do when they volunteer for the police that's not analysis?
They'll volunteer in our victim assistance unit, and it's great. They get lots of experience there. Okay. They learn all our systems, and that's what's really key is I tell them, if you can get on in any position as a volunteer within the police service and have access to our databases and learn how to use them, that will definitely be a bonus for you because then they can hit the ground running when they're hired, right? And so I say take any volunteer position you can, or we also have two other positions called information coordinator and analytical technician. If you can get either one of those positions, that's heading towards being an analyst. So I encourage them to just get on with the police service, get the members to know you, and then keep applying and just try to get your foot in the door through volunteering, and you never know where it can go from there.
And then I just out of curiosity is your students there at the university versus maybe some of the students you taught in the US, is there anything unique to your students there at the university that stands out?
No, not much. They're very similar students, except the students that we have in FIAT and IACA, right, are all law enforcement. Mm-hmm. Whereas my students are getting their degrees in criminal justice or psychology and all that. So the students that we teach in FIAT, they have a more understanding of law enforcement than my students do, but they just have this love for learning. They want to hear it all. They just want to talk about it and learn what it's like, what the culture's like, what it's been like the time I've been an analyst.
I sound like sponges. Good deal.
Yeah, they are, yeah.
So you've been teaching for over 20 years. When I ask you what's changed over the last 20 years, what are some things that stick out?
Oh, the technology, of course, right? Like when I was in District 3 with my first job, we were using pin maps. And so it's so funny now that GeoTime is so automated compared to what that was like. But yeah, it's just the automation, everything, and electronics, seizing cell phones, all of that information, burlas out of cars, like being able to pull all the information out of a vehicle. Like that just gives us so much data that we never had before. It's changed dramatically over the 20 years. And I think too, we've just gotten, as analysts, we've gotten, as a team, we know what our value is and what we can bring to an investigation. Whereas when we first started, it was a relatively new position, right? So now we come into a team and we're like, this is what we can do for you. And so I think it really helps that we do have that confidence and the years of experience. So what we can bring to them.
Let's get into some advice that you have for our audience. Question I always like to ask is, what would you recommend that somebody study now that's going to have the most return on investments 5 years down the road?
I know a lot of my students are in the criminal justice program, right? But mm-hmm. I always encourage them to take ArcGIS, take mapping programs, any kind of, if you can get I2, you know, if you can get that course, take it now. So you have access and knowledge of all the products that we produce in the service already before you get hired. And also, I always say, you know, be a lifelong learner, take as many courses as you can, but also kind of find your niche and become an SME in that area. If you want homicide, pick homicide. If you want intelligence, pick intelligence, but work your way towards that. Because my whole career has been spent in organized crime, and it's been fantastic, different areas of organized crime, but I love every section I'm in. So it's like, become an SME in that area. And later on in your career, that's going to bode really well for you, right? So it's something that you can move out and you can be a consultant, different avenues for you when you're at the end of your career. And also one thing that I know for sure is work with your analyst and become a team. Because as analysts, we're all working through this together and we will always be support for each other throughout our careers. The officers get promoted, move on, all of that. And they're great resources to have. But if you have a really strong analyst team, it's amazing how dynamic you can be.
That's interesting. I would add for those listening that if you identify programs at a agency that you're interested in, most of those that you recommended, whether it's I2 or an ESRI product or a lot of the vendors will give you some kind of demo version. Yep. And so you can get like a 30-day demo of it, most likely be able to jump on YouTube
and
learn a couple of different things in that 30-day demo. So there's definitely opportunities, and there's usually a very cheap version for a student version as well that I would suggest. Again, if you're targeting a particular software, there's usually a low-cost student version that you can
Absolutely.
Start learning.
Yep, there is.
As you've progressed throughout your years, another question I like to ask is, what hasn't law enforcement analysis figured out yet that you thought they would by now? So you started in the 90s, it's now 2021, and you're thinking like, I cannot believe we are still worrying about that issue.
Well, for me, it's to do a lot with how they collect the data and how we can't get it out of our RMS still the way we would like to. And there's still issues that when I started 20 some years ago, I'm still hearing the same names of people coming across bulletins and things like that. And I'm like, I can't believe that guy is still alive for one thing and doing the same thing that he was 20 years ago. So I find that it's frustrating that we don't have more people focused on the hardcore criminals, right? Like DOT teams, which is really good, they're district operating teams, and that's great because they can focus. But everybody is kind of so tapped out and so overworked right now, they can't get to the stuff that they really want to. Like half the time, they're just skimming the surface because they have so many calls that our members have to get to. So you can't blame them for not being able to do an in-depth call on every single one of them. They're just trying to get through the calls. And that's the hard part, is what we find, because for us, that's where we get our data from, right? Is the calls and, mm-hmm. and identifying people. And for me, it's human trafficking now. How can we get them to identify it better and make it easier for them? Things like that. But yeah, I just find we kind of drop the ball in that sometimes that there are organized crime groups that have been around since I started, and they're still doing exactly what they were doing. So it's a little bit frustrating, and usually it's a manpower issue.
So you have gone through a lot of training over the years. Mm-hmm. And is there one particular training that sticks out that was really beneficial to you that you would highly recommend?
Yes, the FBI violent crimes course at UCLA. I've been to it 6 times, and it's still by far the best training I've ever had. Hmm. It's so, every summer.
And what makes it unique?
They use real cases. They take a step-by-step through. If the FBI has any new technology, they share it with us. And they are very willing to take some of our cases. We took one of our cases down there and had 4 profilers look at it. And they're really willing to work with you through any kind of case that you have. And that's what I found about every single year I've been. They have extremely interesting topics. And it will be something new that they have learned or some new technique or tool that they're bringing to the table. So it's always relevant to what we're working on. So yeah, by far, it's the best one.
So you have some experience with geotime. I want to get your take on geotime for those that maybe haven't used it, maybe some pros and cons that you found from using the software.
Well, definitely it's a time saver. We were able to get geotime in 2012, and it saves us time. On average, it was about 1 to 2 weeks of cleaning the data. This is for production orders or tracker data. And it depends on how detailed it is, but it could be 1 to 2 weeks, whereas this is 1 to 2 days you can do it with geotime. It just, we standardize the data and it's put right into the software, and location, proximity, all the information we need right there to tell a story. And also you can provide a video there of the locations where the cell tower was pinging off of. So it's just made our world as analysts so much easier in terms of showing the locations from the cell data.
And then how did it help you when you were testifying?
Well, it's very straightforward, and we create a PowerPoint. And so we can testify to it and explain it point by point where they were located. It says the date, the time, the location, and who the phone is we believe to be belonging to. So, and we can compare this to tracker data to say, you know, the vehicle was here at this time and the phone was pinging in the same area at the same time.
And then are there any cons?
No, I find the software excellent.
And then how about i2? You've done some work with those. What's some pros and cons with i2?
Oh, I've used i2 since I started. It's excellent. Helps us show associations, timelines, and it's more of a product. We don't usually produce it for court. But what it is, it can show the investigators the timeline of all the events, who and how they're associated, not just a name, but how their businesses are associated or family members, all of that. It really paints a really great visual for the investigators to understand what's going on in the investigation. The only con for us is that it's quite expensive, but we've had it for years. So,
yeah, I would say, and it's been years. Well, it's been decades. I say years. It's been decades since I've used i2. But I remember, this is back probably 2010-ish, that it seems like they were coming up with a solution, an i2 solution, where it went from database, data management, and you were going from like RMS, linking it into the i2 solution and having it as an entire platform.
Right.
Which, if you can afford that and buy all into it and that fits well in your department, that works. But if you just want a software that's going to allow you to create timelines or do link associations that you build yourself, then it is pretty expensive to get there.
Absolutely.
And I remember, what was it? RF Flow. You know, I don't know if RF Flow is still around these days, but that was a software that either was free or was very cheap. It was like $25, $50 or something like that. And it just did that. You just used it. It didn't link to any data warehouse. You brought the data in and you did the timelines, you did the links. And there was an import function, but it was very straightforward and very easy to use. But it was that end tool that some folks wanted because they didn't need a data warehouse. They didn't need a whole solution from
right.
i2.
Yeah. Well, we've just been very fortunate to have it for this many years. And we do import our data in, and it works really well for us. But yeah, it is quite pricey.
let's finish up talking about IACA and IALEA, because you've done work for both and you've done teaching for both and you're part of both, which I find interesting because it's usually folks are either one or the other.
Yeah.
But I guess, why have you chosen to be part of both?
I think because I was hired as an instructor for IALEA back in 2010 and for FIAT, right? And I just really enjoyed the intel side of crime analysis. And I figure for the end of my career, I'll probably go into the intelligence unit. And so I wanted to learn as much as I could about intel. And then I love teaching for FIAT. I just find that the being able to meet all the students and just being able to share what we know is very rewarding for me. And then I'm with IACA because there's so many tools that we get for crime analysis. And we have so many of the vendors at every conference that we can learn from, like that's where we got GeoTime, right? And so it's just things like that, that I like being on both sides, because then when I'm sharing my information with my students and my knowledge, I'm coming from both angles, an intel angle and a crime analyst angle.
That's interesting that you say that. I didn't really think about that in terms of the vendors at the conference. That's fascinating. And you're also a mentor as well for, is it just for IACA or are you a mentor for IALEA as well?
No, just IACA and Mount Royal University. Okay. I'm a mentor for them there as well too.
Okay. And then see that mentoring, that fits in perfectly with your desire to teach.
Yeah.
And do you find that experience different from teaching?
I do, because a lot of the mentees that I've had are students and they're not working in law enforcement yet. They want my help on how to do that, what they can do to become a better candidate. And then I've had a couple that are first and second year analysts, and just being able to share with them my experience. And if they're having any kind of issues or they don't know how to do something, I'm able to teach them how to do that. Or if they're having experience and they're saying, well, what would you do? That kind of stuff. It's like teaching, right? You're just, you're right. It's the same as bringing something to the table that I can share with them based solely on my experience as an analyst. So I do really enjoy the mentoring.
And late last year, I created a top 10 list of most influential members to the association. IACA turned 30. I was curious, JC, if you had a top 5 members list.
I absolutely do. Stephen Gottlieb, from when I first started, his book From First Arrest to Final Report was iconic throughout my entire career. Mark Stowell, he was instrumental in saying how important Microsoft Office was and GIS. Julie Wortel, Exploring Crime Analysis. I use that textbook in my course now at Mount Royal University's. Rachel Boba, she taught me a lot on crime mapping. Her work was really instrumental and helpful in crime mapping. And then Chris Bruce, when I taught in Virginia, he taught me a lot about tactical analysis and how to teach the course to analysts.
Very good. Well, those were at least either on my list or honorable mentions during my episode. So thank you for doing that. And you mentioned the textbook, Exploring Crime Analysis. This is a good time for me to plug. I am running a contest right now. In my chapter on Excel, I have put an Easter egg in that chapter from years ago. And if you can identify the Easter egg, email us at leapodcasts@gmail.com. The first one I will send a $20 Amazon gift card for.
That's excellent.
Well, let's talk a little bit about FIAT. And that's where you and I met. You know, I teased you a little bit about putting your FIAT hat on earlier.
Yeah.
How many courses have you taught now?
Oh, I don't even know. I've been at it for 10 years. I would say at least 10 or 15 courses.
Wow. And I don't even remember how many I've done. I'd have to look back. It's like, I think I did about 5. I can't remember. But they have certainly revamped the course since I've last taught it. So have you taught during the recent upgrades?
I have. And a few years ago, I was at the conference and they still needed to upgrade the communication analysis, that one. And I'm not sure if it has, because I haven't taught in a couple of years. I was supposed to teach in the Netherlands in April, but because of COVID, it's been pushed off till next year. Yeah, but they were updating the communication analysis, the tactical analysis, and because there's a lot of things that they believe that the fundamentals need to be taught, but everything is electronic now. Like you don't need to do all the basic fundamentals. And so they were looking at revamping all of it so we would be more current.
Okay. And then Just give a little plug for Fiat, why I have you here. You know, you're an instructor. Just let the audience know why they should sign up for the Fiat training.
Oh, it's so good, because what it does is it gives you the basics. We go through all the different types of analysis that you do, all the things you're going to be asked to do. And it's just a broader understanding of what crime analysis is, right? An intelligence analysis. You can add value to any investigation and make sure that the biggest thing we said, make it actionable and you're giving recommendations. That's the biggest thing we push in Fiat, is that it can be of value, but if you're not giving recommendation, there's really no point of doing it.
All right. Well, I think I just thought of my last question. My last question to you is, being from Canada, what do you find odd about the United States? Maybe this is a custom or something that you've seen that you just really find odd.
Well, the drug loads, the kilos of drug seizures that you get is amazing to us, like kilos and kilos of it. And then the second for me is your access to information. It just seems like your analysts have access to a lot more information than we do up here in Canada.
And I also think that the penalties you give your criminals compared to us, it is night and day. We would ship everybody down there if we could.
I actually thought you were going to do a hockey reference there for a second when you said penalty.
No.
Anything outside of law enforcement?
Well, you guys, your American flag is everywhere you go. You see that? You don't see that a lot in Canada. The American flag is everywhere you go, which I think is great. And no, that's about it.
That is funny. There was some top 10 list or whatever it was a couple of years ago that I clicked on, and it was the top 10 odd customs the U.S. does that the rest of the world doesn't understand. And the American flag was on there about putting that in the yard and or putting that on the side of your house or whatnot. And I just assumed everybody did that. I didn't realize that that was unique to the U.S.
Yeah, that's one thing we noticed. And we do have it here, but it's not prevalent like it is down with you guys.
So our last segment of the show is Words to the World. And this is where you can promote any idea that you wish. Tracy, what are your words to the world?
Well, I'm thinking the biggest thing for analysts right these days is, yes, it's changed a lot. It really has. And you're going to work with, like we say, millennials. You're going to work with senior analysts, all that kind of stuff. But become a team. Really become a team and use each other's expertise. Because we all know there's not a lot of money for training, but we can help each other. And find that core group of people that you really trust. And it's going to become like a family. And I also think that, well, because this is a teacher in me, take as many courses as you can. Just keep learning. Every opportunity you get, keep learning and bringing it back and applying it. Like, always make sure that you're applying everything you learn to help with your analysis and make you a better analyst, because that's going to bode well for you down the road when you're going to be moving units and all that kind of stuff. And finally, become an SME, subject matter expert. Find what you love and get into that unit and show them that you're the best at it, because you will be so valuable to the team. They'll never want to lose you. They will just want to keep you because of your value. And that's what really matters.
Very good. Well, I leave every guest with, you've given me just enough to talk bad about you later.
Yeah.
I do appreciate you being on the show though, Tracy. Thank you so much, and you be safe.
Thanks, Jason.
Thank you for joining us today on Analyst Talk with Jason Alder. We hope you not only enjoyed the show, but also learned something new. For more information on our guests and information relating to today's topic, please visit our website at leapodcasts.com. Special thanks to The Rough and Tumble for our theme song. For more of their music, you can visit their website at theroughandtumble.com. Also, thanks to Kyle McMullen for our show logo. For more of his design, please visit his website at moderntype.com. The show is hosted, recorded, and edited by Jason Alder and written by me, Mindy. You can contact us both via the LEA Podcast website. Please join us again next time as we interview another expert in this great field.